if you're watching the recording, maybe you might want to wait for the 10th lecture and then watch the 9th lecture before after that. So yeah, there's that. So yeah, today the topic is going to be an overview of ADI-CFT. Mostly, I'm not going to use anything that you might have seen in Pedro's lectures, except for maybe the Penrose diagram of ADS, and that's pretty much it. So yeah, of course, it's useful to be aware of the technical stuff that he talked about and the specific examples of ADS-CFT dualities and so on. But what I'm going to focus on today is much more big picture, you know, inspirational stuff, that kind of thing. So I guess I should say just the basics, right? What is ADI-CFT? So ADI-CFT is a conjecture duality between dynamical theories of gravity, quantum theories of dynamical gravity, I should say, in asymptotically ADS spacetimes in, let's say, D plus one dimensions. And conformal field theories, which is a particular class of quantum field theories, defined in non-dynamical spacetimes. With one fewer spatial dimension. Right? So this is the most generic, broadest statement of the duality. And the cartoon that you should have is the following, right? So this is the part I'm gonna assume of Pedro's lectures. You have global ADS, which I'm just going to write it down here for completeness. The line elements in ADS D plus 1 can be written in global coordinates like this, right? Right? There's a radial coordinates, the time-like isometry, and the angular directions. Or if you want, you can also write it like this. Right? Where L is the ADS radius, it's the curvature scale of ADS. And this curly R is related to this R by tangent of little r is r over l, right? And the reason why this is useful is just because it emphasizes that, it emphasizes two things, right? First, the presence of an asymptotic boundary, a conformal boundary, which sits at a finite value of this curly r coordinate. Right, and it also shows that the conformal boundary is contains a time direction and a sphere. So this is why you have the cylinder picture here. Okay, so this is the time coordinates. These are like the sphere in D minus one dimensions. Right, and so let's see. Before that. And before I write anything else, like if you have the full cylinder, you can cut one spatial slice here, let's say, and you can draw a sort of a causal diamond that goes like this. See what I did there? And now if you unwrap this, then you get something like this actual causal diamond, which is the Penrose diagram of asymptotically flat space. So two particularly useful cases of the duality are, which are made explicit by that drawing, or somewhat explicit, is that global ADS in D plus 1 is related to some theory that's defined on the boundary. So I'm coming here, it's a conformal field theory in D dimensions, where the background space-time is time of the sphere, right? It's that second metric I wrote there at a fixed value of r equals pi over 2 without the divergence conformal factor.
So like in that Kolff diagram, the two outside points are identified.
Sorry, what?
In the diagram, in the diamond, those two points are identified.
Yes, yeah. But when I draw, yeah, that's true. So both are like spatial infinity in asymptotically flat space. Yeah. So the statement is that global ADS in D plus 1, by global ADS, I mean the full ADS cylinder, is dual to a conformal field theory defined on the sphere, right? And the region on the bulk that's bounded essentially by shooting light rays from those diagonal lines that I drew to the bulk is called the Poincaré patch. So the other statement of the correspondence is that the Poincaré patch in ADS D plus 1 is some conformal field theory in dimensions now in Minkowski. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. So now you know what ADS-CFT is. You might be wondering why it is interesting. So why do we care about ADS-CFT? Why care about ADS-CFT? You might object that we don't live in ADS, so what's the point? And the point is that ADS-CFT is useful for a lot of things. First, it is a tool for studying strongly coupled QFTs, right? If you have some complicated conformal field theory, but you know that this can be somehow mapped to some effective gravitational model in one extra dimension, then computations can get hopefully easier. And this is something that does happen in some particular examples. So perhaps if someone ever asks you of a real world application of ADS-CFT, that's probably the closest you're going to get, so far, at least. The other application is for a potential non-perturbative definition of, I should say, quantum gravity, but not any quantum gravity, like it's some theory of quantum gravity. Meaning string theory. So the idea is that string theory, as you're taught in textbooks and so on, is first and foremost a perturbative scheme to compute scattering amplitudes and powers of the string coupling. And ADS-CFT could be a way to define a non-perturbative version of that by relating that to some conformal field theory. That's non-gravitational, just usual quantum mechanics with some complicated set of degrees of freedom, perhaps, but still not dynamical space-time, usual quantum field theory, so we understand it better, hopefully. But none of these are the actual reason why I'm talking about ADS-CFT today. The reason why we are interested in ADS-CFT for the purpose of this course is because ADS-CFT is by far the most solid framework to study holography. this is what I'm gonna pick. Can I do this? No. Is this going? Okay, so the idea of holography is somewhat loose and vague at times. What I have in mind here is the idea that in any reasonable quantum gravitational theory, it just so happens that observables are defined not with respect to localized spatial regions, but they have to be defined in relation to some sort of asymptotic boundary structure. Right? A localized version of that would be something like the Bekenstein-Hawking bound, which limits the amount of information that can fit into a localized region of spacetime. That bound being given by the area of some particular surface. But yeah.
So could you speak a little bit more slowly?
Am I speaking too fast? Okay. I'm gonna try. Sorry. I guess when I get nervous, I speed up my speech. Well. Okay, so the idea of holography, at least the most direct way I'm going to be using it now, is that observables in a theory of quantum gravity in some localized region are actually defined in relation to asymptotic boundaries. If you're talking about localized regions of finite size, those would be defined in relation to the boundary, the spatial boundaries of those regions, and that gives rise to the Bekenstein bound, which relates the maximum amount of entropy you can fit into one given region by the area of the surface that bounds that region. And here I want to think of holography as this idea of defining things with respect to asymptotic boundaries, because that's what's most relevant to ADS, right? And so having said that, am I doing better now?
I think so.
Okay. Sure. Okay, so yeah. So there are a couple of reasons why. So we expect holography to be a general feature of quantum gravity theory, as I was saying. But there are a couple of reasons why it is particularly nice and well adapted to be phrased in ADS. And these reasons are like, okay, so let's see, why is holography? I'm gonna put easier. It's not easy, right? But you get what I mean. Why is holography easier in ADS? And I'm gonna say there are like three main reasons for that, for why you shouldn't be surprised that something like that exists. The first is that the boundary of ADS is time-like. Which is clear from the way I drew that diagram there, because you have a time-like direction serving as a time that goes up. And the reason why this is useful is because I can directly place some notion of quantum mechanical theory just in our ordinary day-to-day sense that lives just on the boundary, which could somehow be the theory that encodes this information about the bulk. If you want to do that in asymptotically flat spacetimes, you have basically two ways of doing that. You might, so asymptotically flat spacetime, as I said, is the causal diagram looks something like this. So the asymptotic boundary is null. I have two ways of doing holography, like loosely speaking. You can either place some asymptotic observer at some large but finite radius, right? But that puts an explicit cutoff on the range of gravity, and that's, to some extent, that's fine, but go ahead.
Can I suggest that you write more of what you're saying, a larger fraction of what you're saying?
Okay, sure.
Yes. Comments that you're not really writing down on the board. I recommend writing a larger fraction of the things that you say. I think that will make it clear.
Okay. Okay, let's see what's most important to say about this. Okay. Okay, so the fact that ADS is time-like, the boundary of ADS is time-like, means that you can place an ordinary, observer, which carries their own rulers and clocks and so on and measure stuff only restricted to the boundary at synthetic boundary. Perhaps I should also say that when I write stuff like this, I'm being a bit cavalier because this is not really the asymptotic the boundary of ADS. This is the conformal boundary of ADS because if I just write naively the conformal the boundary of ADS and I write down the induced metric there, it's all divergent. The conformal boundary is essentially seeing ADS as the interior of that boundary, and interior of that cylinder. You strip away the conformal factor there by conformal transformation, and then you see the boundary of that conformally related metric as the conformal boundary. But again, this is mostly relevant for now. Yeah, and the reason why, as I was saying, the reason why this is different from asymptotically flat spacetime is because in asymptotically flat spacetime, the boundary is null, right? So you will either place an artificial finite radio cutoff, or you have to deal with some quantum field theory that's defined at null infinity, which is possible, but it's less obvious by far. So there is such a thing as celestial holography, which is growing very fast recently. But well, I don't know anything about celestial holography, so I'm going to leave it at that. But yeah. In ADS, this notion of placing a asymptotic observer at some time-like boundary and so on is already done for you by the negative curvature. So that's nice. Now, the second reason, let's see. One, two, is that the asymptotic symmetry group of ADS in D plus one dimensions, you can work it out. It happens to be SO2, D, right? If you were in Pedro's lectures, you could probably guess it by thinking of ADS as this hyperboloid in one extra dimension, right? You write down a Minkowski-like metric with one extra time direction, and you place ADS as a hyperboloid on that, and you ask what are the transformations that preserve the location of the hyperboloid, and with that visualization, it's clear that it's a SO2, D. And this is also the symmetry group. Let's see. This is the conformal group in the dimensions.
Why are you calling it the asymptotic symmetry group and not just the symmetry group?
Because I want my spacetime to be not ADS. That would just be one fixed solution in gravity. And that's not dynamic gravity. I really want to have something that I could change in the interior. And all that matters for this argument so far is that this approaches that asymptotic structure. So you could have something like black holes in the interior or scattering and so on that change the geometry. The important bit is that the asymptotic structure doesn't change. Right. So the fact that these two match essentially means that whatever theory I have in the boundary that describes my bulk could be organized in a way that manifestly preserves this symmetry group. And that would be a conformal field theory. Right? And last, which is perhaps it's not an independent reason, but I think it's important to single it out explicitly, is that ADS has the causal structure of a box, let's say. And what I mean by that is that if you take that drawing literally, right? Because the causal diagram is such that light rays follow 45 degree lines and so on, you could send signals to the bulk and catch them back in a finite coordinate time. And actually in a finite proper time from the perspective of the asymptotic observer, right? In the boundary. So you could picture something like you have some point here with coordinates t1, omega 1, in the boundary. You have some signal that's sent to the bulk. It scatters off some point here in the bulk, and it flies back to the boundary, and you catch that at some time t2, and some angle omega 2, right? And all of this happens in a finite time from your perspective. So this suggests, I mean, this is a very hand-wavy argument, but it makes it, believable, at least, that physics in the bulk is related to the kind of observable that would relate to these two locations, let's say, to correlation functions on the boundary. And these correlation functions are organized as in a CFT. So you kind of close the argument here to have this whole nice structure that you can make use of. And by the way, now, having said that,
maybe I missed it, but could you be more specific about what do you mean by physics in the bulk?
I was purposely vague about that because in the simplest case, I could ask about, for example, if I have a scalar that lives in an ADS bulk, right? A scalar field theory in a fixed background. So we're in the regime of a quantum field theory, curved spacetimes kind of situation. I can essentially solve for the dynamics of the quantum field inside by defining data that lives on the boundary alone. Then I can compute correlation functions in the bulk by just having correlation functions in the boundary. And yeah, that's it. Is that more?
Yeah. And
is that better for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also another question about do we need to be a little bit more careful for d equals to 1, or it's that statement is fine for d equals to 1?
Yeah, I guess you need to be more careful for d equals 1. Because for d equals 1, you'd have the CFT will live in zero spatial dimensions, right? It'll be just time.
Okay. By d equals one, I guess I mean one space plus one time. Because in that case,
do you mean the CFT is in 1+1 or the ADS bulk is in 1+1?
CFT is in 1+1.
Okay, so you have ADS 3, CFT 2.
Right, and I think in that case the conformal group is larger than that. No.
Yeah, I mean the. It's the usual difference between the global conformal group in two dimensions and the local conformal group. It's still true that the global conformal group in two dimensions, the one that is well defined on the whole Riemann sphere and so on, is SO2, 2. That's also true in CFT2. So it kind of checks out. But yeah.
I don't need to worry about those additional.
I think you do need to worry about it. I'm just not going to worry about them now. But yeah. ADS 3 CFT2 is special precisely because of that reason, or the extra niceties that you have in CFT2. But yeah, it's good to keep that in mind when you work out explicit examples, but let's just say that I will not touch CFT2 here. So.
Well, Bruno, just a small question. So at this point, right, these 3 points you brought up, it's not obvious to me why the CFT has to be strongly correlated here.
Oh, yeah, that's not, so. Yeah, I don't have an easy argument for that.
Yeah, but
except for
at this point, we really know that there's only ADS, there's only one CFT, but I really don't know if the duality is strong weak or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. From these arguments alone, you don't know that. Okay, so, yeah. Now that you have this setup, and if you actually believe the duality and you imagine that there is some usual, some ordinary quantum field theory that's defined in the asymptotic boundary of ADS, so in that sphere with some time-like direction, you know that, so on the boundary, let's say, causality, or the fact that the boundary theory has some well-defined Hamiltonian that evolves initial data on some fixed time slice to the future and to the past. This implies that, what should I say? The dynamics is defined in terms of data, the evolution, let's say. In terms of data at a fixed time slice. Right? This is just a statement that in a usual quantum field theory, or even in classical field theory, if you give me initial conditions on a given time and you have some well-defined Hamiltonian for a system, you can evolve it to the past and to the future. So all observables can be obtained by just defining data on the slice. And if you believe this point, then this means that in the bulk, I'm going to say here, physics again, being vague, but I hope you know what I mean by context. In the bulk, physics is defined or encoded in data on the asymptotic boundary, or let's say just the boundary of a fixed T slice as well. All right. So again, what I mean by that is much less trivial than the boundary statement, than the boundary version of that. What I mean is that if I pick a full interior region of the bulk, the duality states that everything that happens here is fully encoded into things that are defined just on the boundary. Right?
Wait, is that now like a mathematical statement in terms of like a holomorphic function or something?
It is a holomorphic. So there is a concrete realization of this idea, something called. So for, as I was saying, for real scalar fields that are non-interacting, for free scalar fields in ADS, this can be worked out explicitly. There's something called, or free scalars in pure ADS. There's something called the HKLL construction. And what happens here is that you can write down essentially the full solution to the correlation functions on the bulk between scalar fields that live in the whole ADS bulk by just defining initial data or boundary conditions, in this case, supported on the points that are space-like separated from that point. So you can turn this into a precise mathematical statement, if that's what you're asking.
I was wondering whether the second statement about the bulk was now a physical statement or a mathematical statement.
What would be the distinction between them?
Because in the first you say causality implies that evolution is defined, okay, in terms of data that makes T-slice, but then I didn't see the difference to the second statement right now.
Well, the difference is that here, what I'm saying is that the dynamics on the boundary is defined on a fixed time slice of the boundary. So that's not surprising, right? What is more surprising is that information on this whole slice here that cuts through the bulk is also encoded in data defined on the asymptotic boundary, right? So you cannot use causality in a naive sense to say that data that's defined on this point actually defines the physics that happens in space-like separated regions from this point.
That's not due to causality.
Yes. Yeah. Because the crucial thing here is that this time slice is achronal, so it's every point here is space-like separated from the other. So you cannot imagine that you have this initial data propagating to the bulk in some way that you can just say that's bulk causality. It's something more complicated than that, which is why this is less trivial. Okay.
I have a question about how you describe the HKL construction. that sounded a lot simpler than like a string theory of quantum gravity and the bulk. You were just talking simply about like correlation functions and stuff. So would that be like a formulation of ADS-CFT that does not involve string theory at all? Or is string theory like secretly there?
So the caveat here is that if you do this with just a fixed ADS bulk, and like you can define essentially this map between boundary data and ADS correlation functions by doing this HKLL construction and so on. And in that way, you can define like from the bulk to the boundary a conformal theory, right? Because if you do that, then you can show that essentially because of these arguments, anything that you define on the boundary by extrapolating bulk data to asymptotic infinity will organize itself into a conformal theory that affects the symmetries of the conformal group and so on. The problem in that case is that because you don't have dynamical gravity in the bulk, right, you're just doing quantum field theory in a fixed curved spacetime, the boundary theory will not have an energy momentum tensor, right? Because I mean, this is not supposed to be clear from what I just said, but it is a fact that the energy momentum tensor of the boundary is precisely related to the metric fluctuations in the bulk. So if you want a fully fledged conformal field theory at the boundary with a local energy momentum tensor, you need to allow for fluctuations in the bulk for the metric too. And once you take that into account and you include gravitons and so on, then you find out that the theory in the boundary has to be strongly coupled, and it's hard to describe because you don't have much control over the degrees of freedom and so on. And so the purpose of string theory in that case is to give you something like a recipe to come up with concrete examples that realize the duality. Right? Does that make sense?
For any like dynamic gravity that has to involve strings in this correspondence.
I don't know if it has to. From what we know so far, yes, it has to involve strings because that's the only quantum mechanical description of excitations of the gravitational field that we have that fits into this picture, right? So yeah. But Okay, so HKLL, as I was saying, is a precise way to map a particularly simple sector of this ADS-CFT ideology into a concrete mathematical statement that encodes physics on the bulk with data that's defined on the boundary. But a natural question that can follow so the problem is that this works, right? HKLL works, but it defines points. It defines the data on the bulk in terms of information that sits in the whole ADS boundary, right? So it's non-local from the boundary perspective. The natural question, which goes by the name of subregion duality, let's see, is the following. Given a subregion, let's say R, of a fixed time slice of the bulk, of the boundary, sorry, what is the bulk subregion that is encoded within that spatial subregion of the boundary? Does the question make sense? So the idea is that, let's say, I cut a slice here from ADS and I look at from the top. So this is a fixed time slice. The boundary is a sphere on where the CFT lives, and the interior is the ADS bulk. HKLL works out to give the physics on any given point in terms of data that's defined on the whole ADS boundary, right? Now I can ask, if I pick a subregion R of the spatial slice, you can ask, what can you learn about the bulk by just having information about this spatial slice? Okay? And in order to answer this question, perhaps this is going to be the most technical part of the lecture, I just have to review a few technical concepts. About causal structure in curved spacetimes. For any region A, we call D of A, or the domain of dependence of A, the set of points or set of events, events being spacetime points, that are fully determined by points in A. And we also have the notion of J plus and minus, which is the causal future or past of region A. And this is the set of points or events that can be reached by future or past oriented causal curves emanating from A. So this is one of those ideas that are hard to explain in words, or a trivial when you draw a picture. So the idea is that I have a region A. The domain of dependence, D of A, is the set of points whose full dynamics can be mapped to something that happened on A. So it would be precisely this other diamond. So this is D of A, D of A. And the future and past, and the causal future and causal past are the points that can be reached from data on A. So it'd be something like this future light cone is G plus of A. And same goes G minus of A. Okay? Okay. Now, we are also going to use some annotation for d hat, right? And this is just because we have two spacetimes in ADS. We have the ADS bulk and the asymptotic boundary, which also has some notion of boundary causality. And d hat will just be the notation for the boundary restricted domain of dependence. Right. So this is the same thing as the domain of dependence. When you require that all the causal curves are restricted to live on the boundary. Right. Okay. So with all this preparation, I can state the proposal called causal wedge reconstruction. And the idea is somewhat simple once you have all this preparation. So the question is, I want to define a local subregion on the boundary and ask what bulk information does this encode. So you can picture that what's happening is something like this, right? Let's say you have here some region on the boundary, right? So from the pure boundary perspective, this subregion fully determines physics on its domain of dependence, right? So I can draw some causal diamond that's restricted to the boundary. That's fully determined by data on this slice, right? So if I unwrap this diagram and I look at it from the side, what I have is precisely that picture, this picture here. So I have this is R, this is R, and this is d hat of R, right? And now that I have this full region, I can shoot light rays into the bulk and catch them back by doing the thing that I described there. So if I view this from the side, I have some region R here. Now I'm looking at this from the side, right? So the spherical direction goes through the board. I have this region R, and I have the boundary domain of dependence here, like this. I can shoot light rays in, and the region that can be accessed, where I can both send signals to and receive signals from, is this region here, which is the intersection between the causal future and causal past of this region. So this is J plus intersection J minus out of A. Right? This is perhaps complicated to write down in terms of equations, but I hope the picture helps. And this is what is defined as the causal wedge of A. OK? The causal wedge.
Why is that wedge not the D of R? Just on the back?
You mean why I call this D hat of R and not?
No, for me right now, it just looks like you've basically rotated the cylinder, right?
Yeah, I unwrapped the cylinder. I'm looking at the.
And you also rotated it.
No.
Didn't you say that the spatial direction is into the board?
Yes, the spatial direction on the boundary goes like this.
Yeah.
Right? So it says I cut the cylinder and I opened it.
Oh, sorry, R is along the timeline direction.
No, R is. Sorry, what?
R is secret A.
Oh, did I mix the both? Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, this is R. That's not what you asked, is it?
you rotated the cylinder, no? To go from the cylinder picture to what you drew on the board.
No, I.
You can draw the dotted line there and it will become clear.
You take part of that, no? You slice and then you have a circle and you take part of the circle.
In the R is going to the board.
At any point that's along the circumference of the cylinder from another point.
Yeah.
Is like in and out of the
board from each other. So you have this picture, right? You make a cut here, for example, and you open the cylinder, and you see it as a flat piece of paper, let's say. Now this region is collapsed to a point in the picture, right? So both the circle and the subregion will be just a point in this drawing. So you have to keep in mind that this is a subregion of this region of the spatial slice. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this is called the causal wedge. Can everybody see this? And yeah, the statement is that physics in the causal wedge of R is fully encoded into CFT data or boundary data defined in R. And once again, for the particular case of free scalar fields in bulk ADS, this has been explicitly worked out. And it is true because it really is a classical statement, right? It is like the proof is all about looking at causal propagators that you can define from the bulk equation of motion. And then you send stuff to the boundary and it all checks out.
So the physics. The causal wedge is encoded just in R, not in the domain of dependence on the boundary.
Anything that's on the domain of dependence can be mapped to R. So it's, it's the same thing. Being yeah. Got it. Question? Okay. Okay. So. Okay. So. This simply comes from the causal structure on the boundary and the bulk. And it can be verified in the simplest of examples by simply studying the causal propagator from the equations of motion and so on. So this should also not be that surprising. But you can do even better than that. You can do something called entanglement wedge reconstruction, which is much more powerful. For reasons I hope I'll get to. And entanglement wedge reconstruction is really where the quantum gist of the boundary theory kicks in, because the core of why entanglement wedge reconstruction is the way it is because we imagine that entanglement in the boundary theory, in the field theory. Relates to or builds geometry in the book. All right. So first I'm going to state entanglement-wise reconstruction. And if we have time, I'm going to say a few words about how this relates to causal-wise reconstruction. But let's first see what this is all about. So the key ingredient for entanglement-wise reconstruction is the real Takanagi formula. Which is perhaps the most famous, not perhaps, it's definitely the most famous quantitative connection between entanglement and geometry. It says that the phenomenon entropy of a region R in the bulk, in the boundary, sorry, can be computed as the minimum overall surface chi of area of chi over 4 g newton, where the chi is what we call a bulk surface that's homologous to R. So what do we mean by that? Is that you have R, you have R here. And chi will be a surface such that there is some bulk spatial region whose only boundaries are R and chi. Okay? So you anchor some bulk surface on this boundary, on the endpoints of the boundary. You compute its area, you extremize that, and then you say that that is, you declare that that's the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state for this conformal field theory just on the boundary, on this region R. Okay? So this is the real Takanagi formula. It works for static, and perhaps it should say vacuum like solutions where only the area term contributes. But first and foremost, it's just static case. There is also, so this is the RT formula. There is also the HRT formula, which is a generalization of real Takanagi. And this R is not the same as that R. This is, anyway, the name is too long to write down. So, but this is Hobeni Rangamani Takanagi. So sometimes people will call this whole business HRRT formula. And the RT formula is just the generalization of this when you have bulk quantum fields and time-dependent situations. And the statement is that the entropy of this boundary region R is given by the generalized entropy by the minimum of the extremized generalized entropy for all surfaces chi that are built the same way. And here the difference is that we include the bulk contribution from any matter fields that are supported in this region between chi and R. Okay, so this is the HRT formula, right? The main difference from there are two differences from the real Takanagi case. The difference is being that now this minimization procedure. So in real Takanagi, because you have a static situation, you can restrict this minimization problem, this optimization problem, to just one fixed time slice, because you know that the geometry is not changing as you move in time. So you can just look at how it changes in space. In the HRT formula, the surface is not only minimum, it's not minimal, it's extremal. So you need to vary in time-like directions as well to find what the actual surface you're looking for is. And the other obvious reason, the other obvious difference is that you now care about the contribution from bulk matter fields that are supported inside this region, right? So, yeah. Now, once you do that, you find the extremal surface, which is called the quantum extremal surface, IA, that extremizes. So let's see. The recipe is find the quantum extremal surface, chi A, that extremizes this generalized entropy. Take this spatial slice to be the region that is bounded by chi and R. Oh, I'm mixing stuff again. This is R. But you take this bulk codimension one region C of R such that its boundary is chi R unit R, right? And then you take what we call the entanglement wedge of the region R to be the domain of dependence of C of R. Okay. This is the full bulk domain of dependence, including R, right? So if you just look at that picture, it would be indistinguishable from what I drew there. If that point was the extremal surface. Okay? So the statement, now that we defined what the entanglement wedge is, you can probably guess what the statement would be for entanglement wedge reconstruction. Do you mind if I continue here? Just so that, so statement.
FYI, you should probably try to finish relatively quickly. We're roughly at time.
Yeah. I'm just going to state entanglement wedge reconstruction and be done. The statement is that physics. OK, let's see. The boundary subregion R encodes the full physics, let's use vague language again, in the entanglement wedge of R. Right? This is entanglement wedge reconstruction. It's the idea that the bulk subregion that's dual to a boundary subregion is the entanglement wedge of R, which is defined by this recipe. And before we wrap up, I just have to say that you can show that the entanglement wedge will always contain the causal wedge, which is a good consistency check, because this just comes from pure bulk and boundary causality. You expect that if you have some highly non-classical resource, such as entanglements, you can do much better. And you can see this explicitly by just looking at pure ADS, let's say. If you have two boundary subregions, let's say A1 and A2. And you pick some point that's deep in a bulk P here, right? You have, if these two regions are large enough, you have that the entanglement wedge that you obtain would go like this. Right? So it will include the point P, whereas the causal wedge would just be the disjoint union between the causal wedges of each one of them. And that would obviously not include the point P.
Could you repeat?
So the question I'm asking is
I understood that the causal wedge will not include P.
Yes.
And now you're saying the entanglement wedge would include P?
Yes. So if these two regions are large enough, because the idea is that, let's write it again here. The idea is that you have this region A1, you have this region A2, right? So let's say A1 has this convex external surface chi 1, and A2 has this chi 2, right? But when you join these two regions, or when you think about the quantum state in these two regions together, you have two options of extremal surfaces. Mm-hmm. You have the option of declaring that the extremal surface is chi 1 union chi 2. Mm-hmm. Or you now also have the option of a quantum extremal surface that joins the two together. So it would be like this. Right? This is also, so the surface, let's say chi 1, 2. This is the first part. This is the second part. You know what I mean? Chi 1, 2 is the union of these two. This is also homologous to A1 union A2.
Yeah.
Right. So this is also a candidate extremal surface. Now, the true extremal surface is the one that minimizes the whole quantity.
I see.
So
if chi
1, 2, the area is smaller than the area of chi 1 plus the area of chi 2, then the true quantum extremal surface will be chi 1, 2.
And C would contain P.
And then C would contain D, contain P in this case. Yeah. And this will never happen in the causal wedge. The causal wedge of two disjoint regions is always the disjoint union of each individual causal wedge. Because you can,
I see.
Yeah, because they're always space-like separated. So this is a highly non-trivial statement. And one of the purposes of the next few lectures on ADS-CFT will be to see how this is related to some puzzles that show up when you think about bulk reconstruction in ADS-CFT and how there are some quantum information techniques that can be useful to come up with toy models for this in like more or less explicit setups. So yeah, but this is reserved for the next chapters. Yep. This is what I have for today. Do